Welcome everybody, and I'm pretty mind blown when you survey the room and see where everybody's from and how far all of us have come. So I made a little bit of a comment during our Agape service that sometimes when you're preparing a sermon, maybe somebody can sympathize with me, or even when you're teaching from the Bible, you have one of the longest weeks of your life and you start to second doubt your ability to speak English, your ability to read the Bible, your ability to speak full sentences. And I just reminded our group, like, before you know somebody that's getting up to preach, just to pray for them, because we know that Satan is real and we know that he wants to tear people's confidence apart. So my wife and I, we have a little bit of a running joke in our family that when we picture heaven and Christ's return, I don't know if you've asked somebody, what do you picture when you picture heaven? My wife tends to picture a garden, like a lot of gardening and maybe a really quaint house in like the British countryside or something. And then when you ask me, when you picture a heaven, I'm like, give me a Viking ship, give me a spaceship, give me an adventure, give me endless discovery. And so we've compromised in the middle where it's probably going to be a ship with a garden on it. But so some of this message is going to stem from just one of my passions is just the excitement of life and Christianity as an expedition. And I just think that when you think about some of the great expeditions in life, there's a lot to be excited about serving the greatest king that has ever existed. So our key scripture today is going to be just two verses, Hebrews 12, 1 through 2. So if you want to turn there with me, if not, that's fine. Hebrews 12, verses 1 and 2. Therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Let's pray. Father in heaven, we thank you for the ability to come here this evening. Lord, we think about the circumstances that allow us to practice our religion freely. We thank you that we are here and can open your word and study it. We thank you for your son, and I pray that your word could teach us this evening. So I'm going to ask the audience a little bit of a question. How many of you can name the first two humans who ever summited Mount Everest? Luke. Okay, good. All right. That was good. You should apply to Sattler. Can anybody name the two men who climbed right before them that set up the base camp that made it possible for them to summit? Yeah, I don't think anybody can. So let me read you guys the story of how the summit to Mount Everest was achieved. This is from an article in history.com just titled Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay Reach Everest Summit in 1953. At 11:30 a.m., May 29, 1953, Edmund Hillary of New Zealand and Tenzing Norgay, a Sherpa of Nepal, became the first known explorers to reach the summit of Mount Everest, which at 29,035 feet above sea level is the highest point on Earth. Caveat, does anyone know the highest point from the center of the Earth, since the Earth is oblong? It's Cayambe in Ecuador, just in case you wanted to know. I'm Ecuadorian. So the two, part of a British expedition, made their final assault on the summit after spending a fitful night at 27,900 feet. News of their achievement broke around the world on June 2nd, the day of Queen Elizabeth II's coronation, and Britons hailed it as a good omen for their country's future. Mount Everest sits on the crest of the Great Himalayas in Asia, lying on the border between Nepal and Tibet, called Chomolungma, or Mother Goddess of the Land by the Tibetans. The English named the mountain after Sir George Everest, a 19th century British surveyor of South Asia. The summit of Everest reaches two-thirds of the way through the air of the Earth's atmosphere at about the cruising altitude of a jet airliner's, and oxygen levels there are very low. Temperatures are extremely cold, and weather is unpredictable and dangerous. The first recorded attempt to climb Everest was made in 1921 by a British expedition that trekked 400 difficult miles through the Tibetan plateau to the foot of the great mountain. A raging storm forced them to abort their ascent, but the mountaineers, among them George Leigh Mallory, had seen what it appeared to be a feasible route to the peak. It was Mallory who quipped when later asked by a journalist why he wanted to climb Everest, because it's there. Expeditions. A second British expedition featuring Mallory returned in 1922, and climbers George Finch and Jeffrey Bruce reached an impressive height of more than 27,000 feet. In another attempt made by Mallory that year, seven Sherpa porters were killed in an avalanche. The Sherpas, native to the Khumbu region, have long played an essential support role in the Himalayan climbs and treks because of their strength and ability to endure high altitudes. In 1924, the British launched a third Everest expedition, and climber Edward Norton reached the elevation of 28,128 feet, 900 vertical feet short of the summit, without using supplemental oxygen. 4 days later, Mallory and Andrew Irving launched a summit assault and were never seen alive again. In 1999, Mallory's largely preserved body was found on High Everest. He had suffered numerous broken bones in a fall. Whether or not Irving reached the summit remains a mystery. Several more unsuccessful summits attempts were made via Tibet's northeast ridge route, and after World War II, Tibet was closed to foreigners. In 1949, Nepal opened its door to the outside world, and in 1950 and 1951, British expeditions made exploratory climbs to the southeast ridge route. In 1952, a Swiss expedition navigated the treacherous Khumbu Icefall in the first real summit attempt. Two climbers, Raymond Lambert and Tenzing Norgate, reached 28,210 feet just below the south summit, but had to turn back for want of supplies. Shocked by the near success of the Swiss expedition, a large British expedition was organized in 1953 under the command of Colonel John Hunt. In addition to the best British climbers and such highly experienced Sherpas as Tenzing Norgay, the expedition enlisted the talent from British Commonwealth such as New Zealanders George Lowe and Edmund Hillary, the latter of whom worked as a beekeeper when not climbing mountains. Members of the expedition were equipped with specially insulated boots and clothing, portable radio equipment, and open and closed circuit oxygen systems. Setting up a series of camps, the expedition pushed its way to the mountain in April and May of 1953. A new passage was formed to reach 26,000 feet, and on May 26, Charles Evans and Tom Bordelon launched the first assault on the summit and came within 300 feet of the top of Everest before having to turn back because one of their oxygen sets was malfunctioning. On May 28, Tenzing and Hillary set out, setting up high camp at 27,900 feet. After a freezing, sleepless night, the pair plodded on, reaching the south summit by 9 a.m., a steep, rocky step, some 40 feet high. About an hour later, wedging himself in a crack in the face, Hillary inched himself up what was therefore known as the Hillary step. Hillary threw down a rope, and Norgay followed. About at 11:30 a.m., the climbers arrived at the top of the world. So, I read this story because if any of you have thought about what it takes to summit a mountain, I bet you guys didn't know that there was a colonel, a British colonel, who pulled together the world's greatest climber, and that Hillary and Norgay would have never reached the top had they not have learned from the hundreds of people before them to get to the top. And too often, I think we can get stuck in viewing the Christian faith as like a long individual foot race, but this doesn't really capture the true challenge. Summiting one of the highest peaks gives us a much better picture and births today's message title. So, Summit View Christianity, the Christian life as an expedition. And disclaimer, my in-laws go to a church named Summit View, and there's no ties between this message and that church. But I like the title. So let's think about why should we think of the Christian journey as an expedition and more of a summit than we should think of it as an individual foot race. I think a lot of us, when we read about the race analogy that Paul uses, if you're like me, I kind of picture myself in a marathon rather than myself roped together with a group of other people. It requires teamwork, not just personal endurance. It demands preparation and discipline. Passion won't get you there. And it involves suffering, yet promises triumph. As we work through Hebrews 12, those two verses I read before, I'm just going to work through a quick acronym to capture what I think the essence of this passage is. It'll be the word summit, S-U-M-M-I-T. And we'll also work through a couple other passages in 1 Corinthians 1 and Jesus' final prayer in John 17. So let's think about the word summit before I jump in, and this is where I will build my points from this word. So summit, S, we are surrounded by witnesses to gain perspective. U, we are called to unburden our weights and sin. M, we move forward together. The second M, we use maintenance to envelop endurance. And then I is internalizing Christ. And T, the throne is for triumph. So let's jump right into these verses. Let's start with the S of this idea of surrounded by witnesses. When you are about to do something really, really challenging, and you survey your environment, what's a really good way to recalibrate how hard your life is? Anyone have any ideas? Or has anybody ever been like, man, this is really hard, my set of circumstances. What's a good thing that you do? I do it with my kids sometimes. In Hebrews 12:1, it says, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, you recalibrate by thinking of all the people who've gone before you who had it much, much, much worse than you did. Does anybody ever do that? Or is that just me? I've developed this as a really good habit when I'm sitting there and I'm looking at the task at hand. I'm like, man, my life's hard. And then just for a split second, you think about some of the hardships that others have gone before you. Doesn't that kind of recalibrate how you think about your self-pity and how hard your life is? At Sattler this semester, I had a group of people actually hang up all the paintings that we find in the Martyr's Mirror around campus. And a lot of those paintings are gruesome, and you see depictions of people having their tongue cut off and being burned at the stake. And I actually think we have that on our bookshelf too. Isn't it hard to complain about your life when you have a picture of a martyr right in front of you who has endured a lot of pain and suffering? Oftentimes in our own churches, we have some people who have spent some time in Bangladesh, and a lot of the times when we think about, you know, our material needs or something like that, and then we think back to actually living in places that are in poverty, you just recalibrate your sense of how hard your summit really is. And it's actually great, because then we can also think about the road ahead of us, and we are not alone. We are surrounded by a cloud of witnesses who have endured before us. When climbing Everest, when summiting a mountain, one of the things that people teach you to do, has anybody ever summited a big mountain? I know you've summited some 14,000. Anybody else done a summit?
I was in Italy. I went to Mount Etna.
Mount Etna.
Mount Etna, yeah. I didn't climb it. I went with the Land Rover.
Doesn't count. No, I'm just kidding. It counts. It counts. So one of the things I remember as a young boy, when you're climbing and the air starts getting thin, do you know what people tell you to do? Stop and look behind you. And when you stop and you look how far you've come, you kind of get this reset in perspective. You're like, whoa, look how far I've come. So S is surrounded by witnesses. If you're ever in a hard time, remember those who endured you before you to reset your perspective. And if your family doesn't have this this practice, I would just really encourage, try gaining perspective by reading stories, missionary stories, stories of martyrdom, setting aside an evening on a frequent basis to pray about the solidarity in the world. If my family try on a pretty regular basis to read a story about what's going on right now. And when you survey some of the circumstances that people are in, and then you pray to God, we actually have it really, really good for ourselves. And it's really hard to distract and just forget that there's civil war raging in Africa, there's famine, there's all sorts of things going on. And then also something else that I would recommend to just kind of reset your perspective is eat every once in a while. My wife and I are trying to get in this habit, but eat a simple meal. Try to teach your children what it is to have a meal of rice and beans and nothing else. And try to reset that it's not about your pleasure. It's actually about something much, much bigger. So let's move on to the second part, the you here. Let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us. So this verse is actually, I feel like I could spend a lot of time unpacking the reality in the scriptures that there's a different category that Paul gives between sin or weight and sin. I hope everybody catches that. What does Paul, or the author of Hebrews, I'm assuming it's Paul, what does the author of Hebrews call us to cast aside? Both, weight and sin. So when you think about preparing for a summit or an expedition, if some of you haven't done this, one of the things you always do is you lay out exactly what's going to be in your backpack. Like, you lay it out, you lay the tarp. A lot of people actually trace the items that have to be there. And what's a great practice if you're about to go climb 29,000 feet? You don't want a single extra pound of weight on you, because every pound is going to make it harder and harder and harder. So over time, technology has made it so everybody is paying attention very carefully to what you're carrying with you. And before going on an expedition, training and preparation always come before execution. So I hope there are some people in East Boston who heard me preach a message about a month ago where I was just begging everyone to reconsider how often we justify weights in our life and even sin, where we tend to say to cut corners when I was really aiming at media consumption and saying, hey, if you find yourself on a regular basis saying something to your small group or to the group of people who are holding you accountable, I spent too much time doing this, or I spent too much time doing this, or I confess this, and you find yourself often repeating that, I believe that's a light bulb going off that the Holy Spirit is telling you to cut it out of your life. And I told a story that oftentimes you want to find somebody that's not going to coddle you and say that it's okay that you keep repeating the same things over and over and over. So I don't know if anybody else has any helpful distinctions between sin and weight, other than as a group of people, I hope that we can be ones when we examine the list of things that we're consuming, that especially with media these days, that we look and we say, that's not good for me, and I'm going to cut it out. Identify and remove what hinders your faith journey, and find a guide who won't just coddle you, but can challenge you. I told a story about, some of you know that I went to the Air Force Academy, and I went through something called the jump program, where it's the only program in the world where you jump out of an airplane and your first jump is completely alone. You have nobody on your back, and so all of your training is on the ground. And that training, you can imagine it being really, really intense. And if you are preparing for something very, very intense, do you want somebody who is going to lie to you and tell you that you're ready for something when you're not? What do you guys think? No. So I told the story that the day before us, there was actually an ROTC cadet who went through the program, and his jump master, you have a jump master who clears you for the jump, cleared him, and he ended up steering himself into a power line and cutting both of his legs off the days right before us. And you can imagine that's a sobering, if you're going to jump the next day, you're like, do I really want to do this? And it was sobering for me, and I went and I had a roommate, and we had rules, and my roommate decided that night that he was going to break the rules and he was going to go out drinking that night. And I knew that he was going to come back, and I knew that somebody had just cut their legs off, and there was something called the honor code, where if you know that someone broke the rules, you're supposed to turn them in. And so if you were in my shoes, would you let your roommate jump out of a plane the next day hungover? No. Yeah, so there's a good way around it where you say, you turn yourself in or I will. So he ended up turning himself in. But you don't want to play games with things that are sins and weights. You want somebody that's going to look you straight in the face and say, that's going to kill you. So don't find a guide who will help you cast off the sin and weight in your life. So I want to just segue into the next point here, that there's a lot of things we should leave behind when we go on expeditions, but there are also things that we shouldn't leave behind. So since Hillary and Norgay's historic climb, numerous expeditions have made their way up to Everest summit. In 1960, a Chinese expedition was the first to conquer the mountain from the Tibetan side. And in 1963, James Whitaker became the first American to top Everest. In 1975, Tobai Junko of Japan became the first woman to reach the summit. 3 years later, Reinhold Messner of Italy and Peter Hobler of Austria achieved what had been previously thought impossible, climbing to the top of Everest without oxygen. More than 300 climbers have died attempting to summit the mountain. Everest's deadliest day occurred on April 25th, 2015, when 19 people were killed in an avalanche at base camp following a 7.8 earthquake, which killed more than 9,000 people and injured more than 23,000 in Nepal. A major tragedy occurred in 1996 when 8 climbers died after being caught in a blizzard high on the slopes of an incident made famous by John Crowker's book, Into Thin Air. Crowker's book did nothing to stem the tide of people willing to shell out tens of thousands of dollars for a chance to summit Earth's highest mountain. Traffic jams have been reported near the top, and a fistfight broke out in 2013 between 3 European climbers and more than 100 Sherpas over what the guides deemed to be rude and dangerous behavior during an attempted ascent. Meanwhile, the deaths keep coming, including over 10 in 2019. So I want to pay attention a little bit to this next part, is that although we're called to unburden ourselves, one thing we cannot afford to lose is each other, your expedition partners. Can you imagine being at the top of Everest waiting for the summit and getting in a fist fight with 100 other people? Can you imagine that, Seth? You got a good big eyes, so I mentioned you. It sounds pretty reckless. And when you think about the Christian life and what we're called to be doing here, living faithful lives, I can't help but just put this into perspective, that the next M is to move forward together. And there's a call to unity, and there's also a severe danger of division. So in Hebrews chapter 1, verse 2, I don't know if any of you caught, but if you just go about and count, how many times do you see we, us, or our in that passage when Paul is describing the race? Does anybody have it in front of them? Seth, are you looking? Yeah. So I saw 7, but we don't have to argue. And how many times do you see I, me, or my? 0. So I just want to park on this a little bit. This is a really famous passage, and if the picture for you is a marathon, I just want to really question this idea. Like, Paul is not telling us that the Christian journey is a solo foot race. We are in this together, and the key to get to the top is to stay together and to do everything we can to avoid division. Jesus never intended us to be going on expeditions alone, and he also never intended for his own church to tear itself apart. So let's talk about the call of unity. And I'm just going to read a couple of other passages here that talk about unity and I think are very striking. So 1 Corinthians 1:10, this will be very familiar to all of you. "Now I plead with you, brethren," this is Paul, "by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you all speak the same thing, and that there be no divisions among you, but that you be perfectly joined together in the same mind and in the same judgment. For it has been declared to me concerning you, my brethren, by those of Chloe's household, that there are contentions among you. Now I say this, that each of you says, 'I am of Paul,' or 'I am of Apollos,' or 'I am of Cephas,' or 'I am of Christ.' Is Christ divided? Was Paul crucified for you? Or were you baptized in the name of Paul?" The phrase that strikes me when we think about the expedition is that there be no divisions among you, but that you be perfectly joined together in the same mind and in the same judgment. That's quite the call, for unity. And then I also wanted to just read Jesus' last prayer for his believers found in John 17. This is John 17, verses 9 through 25. I pray for them. I do not pray for the world, but for those who you have given me, for they are yours, and all mine are yours, and yours are mine, and I am glorified in them. Now I am no longer in the world, but these are in the world, that I may come to you. Holy Father, keep through your name those whom you have given me, that they may be one as we are. While I was with them in the world, I kept them in your name. Those whom you gave me, I have kept, and none of them is lost except the sons of perdition, that the scripture may be fulfilled. But now I come to you, and these things I speak in the world, that they may have my joy fulfilled in themselves. I have given them your word, and the world has hated them, because they are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. I do not pray that you should take them out of the world, but that you should keep them from the evil one. They are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. Sanctify them by your truth. Your word is truth. As you sent me into the world, I also have sent them into the world. And for their sakes, I sanctify myself, that they may also be sanctified by truth. I do not pray for these alone, but also for those who will believe in me through their word. I think that's safe to say that Jesus is praying for you and me in this passage, that they all may be one as you, Father, are in me and I in you, that they may also be one in us, that the world may believe that you sent me, and the glory which you gave me I have given them, that they may be one just as we are one, I in them and you in me, that they may be perfect in one, and that the world may know that you have sent me, and I have loved them as you have loved me. Father, I desire that they also whom you gave me may be with me where I am, and they may behold my glory which you have given me, for you love me more than the foundation of the world. O righteous Father, the world has not known you, but I have known you, and these have known that you sent me. And I have declared to them your name, and will declare it, that the love which you have loved me be in them, and I in them. Have you guys ever read through Jesus' last prayer and just kind of paid attention to what I think is, I feel like I can picture Christ just begging God for us. And what's theme did you pick out of his prayer? Well, yeah, unity. The word oneness just, I think, leaps out to me. And when you think about this idea of running the Christian race, I think it's worth just reiterating again that we are called to unity, and I think we are called to do everything we can to stay together, and we're not gonna make the summit or the potential summit if we don't. When Tenzing reached the top of the summit, has anyone ever seen a picture of Tenzing Norgay at the summit of Mount Everest? He has an ice axe, and he actually rolls down a set of flags. Atop of Everest, a Sherpa, pulled out a camera and snapped a picture of him, and he had a flag of the British flag, the Indian flag, Nepal, and the United Nations. And I just think that that's a really beautiful picture of a man getting to the top and then acknowledging that it was everybody who got them to the top, and they would have never, ever been there without all of the support getting to the top there. So I think that we have this intense lesson here to, while we're on the summit and we're going through hard things, maybe we're feeling like we don't have a lot of oxygen, we look at each other and we see each other as allies, especially internally and then also among the Christian world, that I think we're called not to burn bridges and not to cut any ropes. I'll tell a quick story here. Some of you know that I grew up in Ecuador, and I've attempted a couple summits in my life. And before you attempt a summit, you gear up, and you wear a harness, and you clip in. You're clipped into each other because everyone have a picture in your mind, and you're wearing ropes, and you have a backpack, and there's a lead, and there's a tail. And right at the beginning of this climb, I was in the lead, and we were on a mountain called Cayambe. I bragged about Cayambe is the highest point from the center of the earth. So anyway, just wanted to mention that. Better than that. It's much less difficult than Everest. But there was a pile of snow, and I was walking, and we had just started the climb, and so there was a bunch of slack in the rope, and I stepped on, and I actually had stepped on like a, it's called a false, basically a false floor, and I fell 40 feet straight into a crevasse, and I just, I tell this story multiple times. I kind of like landed on the bottom, and I like looked, and there's this rope holding me, and I was like, well, I'm glad I have this rope on, right? And I was sliding. I could feel myself sliding, and there was a thick blue wall of ice right in front of me and right behind me. And I remember I looked up, and it was just dark. I had like come in between, and I was just like, this is it. There's no way I'm getting out of this. And eventually I hear somebody from the top like, Zach, are you down there? And I was like, they're like, try to climb out. And I just remember I had these ice axes, and I was like, I could barely move my body. And then at some point in time, they rigged a little bit of like a snow anchor pulley system to pull me out. But they yelled down to me, and they said like, you're gonna have to unclip your rope. Like, anchor in. And I was like, no, that sounds like a terrible idea. But this is what I think oneness really creates, is the ability to go and do something hard and know that if you fall, that somebody you trust is going to be there holding your rope. And that no matter what, that team of people is going to, like, they're going to be at the top, and they're going to die before they let you, like, die in the mountain. And so I fear-mongered. I said my death prayers, but my friends labored vigorously and pulled me out. And I remember by the time I was out, I could like not even move my arms. But one of my friends had pulled so hard that he was throwing up. He was throwing up on the mountain to pull me out. And I was like, this is what oneness is. So I think when we think about our expedition and our summit, don't treat people who have your back as expendable. They are the ones that we're called to protect. And there's a little bit of another story that's really famous in the mountaineering world called Touching the Void. Has anyone ever heard the book Touching the Void? I've got a couple people here. So this is the opposite story, where two men were summiting a mountain in Peru, and it was a crazy idea for them to do with just two. And on their way up, they didn't make it, and on their way down, a guy breaks his leg, and he can't make it down. It's pitting over the night. And so his friend says, you know what, all right, we're going to rope together, and I'm going to lower you down the mountain 100 feet at a time. And every time I get 100 feet, I'm going to anchor, and then I'll lower you back down. And they were just going to go down the mountain like that. And they had a little signal where once he was anchored, he would like tug on the rope, and that would alert the top friend that he could go walk down, that he was safe. And at one point, he lowers his friend down, and the rope gets taut, and he doesn't feel the signal. And so he's like sitting there, he's like, I wonder what my friend is doing. And it gets so cold, and this guy thinking he's going to die, it's been hours, he's holding on, that he decides to cut to cut the rope, because it's either him or his friend or him. And so he cuts the rope, and what had happened is he had lowered his friend over an edge, and he was just dangling there and couldn't anchor in, had with a broken leg. Long story, it's one of the most amazing stories. He cuts the rope, his friend falls 100 feet into the mountain, he makes it down, and then like 5 days later, his friend like basically bear crawls his way into their camp all bloodied with like 3 broken bones and has survived the fall. Can you imagine being that guy who cut the rope? It's really famous in the mountaineering world. It's always going to be like, are you going to be the one that cuts the rope, or are you going to be the one that doesn't? And that one has a nice ending. But I would just say that in the realm of Christianity, we should be a people who never cut the rope, and are always supporting each other. And maybe we should just spend a little bit of time of painting a picture of what oneness looks like in people. Does anyone have any images in your mind of like people in unity that's really impressive? On, I know we've actually had some sermons on like what potentially the Christian church could look like, or really impressive human examples of oneness. Does anyone have any ideas that come to mind?
Human body.
Human. Okay, that. But like people working together. You know what I mean? So Brother Finn.
During a time of, like, you know, like, try, you know, like, when there's, like, a, say, like a Kelly, like, wow, everybody comes together to help each other, you know, during, like, a tragedy.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, during, like, a storm or, you know. Like,
so, like, first responders. First responders. The first responders' response to 9/11. Yeah. Pretty impressive. Yeah. I know that Brother Finney's preached on, Life Together, Bonhoeffer, and him just looking at the German army and looking at their unity and saying, why is it that they can achieve this, but yet we here as a church, we should be, what does he say, we can should be greater than that or something along those lines. I really want to just touch on this again, that when I think about oneness in my own life, I think about climbing. Obviously, when you're climbing, you really have to trust people. Has anyone here ever learned how to march, or is that just me? Yeah. So in the military, in day one in basic training, they teach you how to march in formation, and it's actually really interesting. Day one, you look like a bunch of, like, toddlers who just learned how to walk, and you're falling over, you don't know what's going on, you're getting yelled at constantly, and then by a week in, you're like in step with each other, your arms are swinging at the same length, you can turn right at the same time, turn left at the same time, you can pivot on the dime. It's actually really impressive what humans can accomplish together. And my other example, has anyone ever here, like, rowed in a boat where you have to feather the paddle? Does anyone know what I'm talking about? Has anyone ever here seen, like, eight-person rowing where there's eight people in a boat? So I did a little bit of a crew tour when I first moved to Boston, and there's eight people in a boat, and you basically have to feather the paddle at exactly the same time and pull. And this is where, if you're a new rower in your boat, you can do something called catching a crab. Has anyone ever heard this term? So if you don't turn your paddle at exactly the same time as your teammates and you put it in the water, then you catch the boat and you can flip it, and your whole team is just like, man, you caught the crab. So it's actually a really good example of how impressive oneness can be. But then I have a great story of me and my buddy. We were both going to grad school, and we got invited to join, and my buddy caught a crab and flipped the boat over on us, and we ended up having to, like, get rescued by one of those little patrol boats. You've probably seen them on the Charles here. And we got out, and my buddy got in a huge fight with the team for this British guy, and he looked at me and he goes, Zach, I'm quitting. You're either with me or you're against me. And I looked at the guys, I'm like, I'm with that guy. I'm like, I gotta stick together with that guy. But I remember learning how to row where I would, and even marching, that when I would fall asleep at night, my mind would try to be, has anyone ever, like, tried to learn something where, like, you're awake at night and you find yourself, like fidgeting with, like, what you're learning? I don't know if, so, like, maybe basketball or something. What's going through your mind?
Yeah.
Basketball? Yeah, sports is a big one. I think in the Christian experience, there's a lot that we can learn from how much humans pay attention to unity and how far we have to go to achieve what Paul's saying there, where we're of the same mind and of the same judgment. And then I wanted to just touch on a little bit of another tangent, is what's even worse than losing unity is actually something called friendly fire. Is everyone familiar with the term friendly fire? So friendly fire is a war term, and that's a term that comes from when you're on the same team and you shoot each other and you're on the same team. I revisited a chapter in a book called Extreme Ownership. I think we've talked about it here. And the term extreme ownership is actually born from an incident of fratricide. So fratricide is the other term for when you kill a friendly. And then in the military, they call it blue on blue. And I actually learned a little bit from the author of that book. It struck me again that friendly fire is avoided by taking personal ownership, but you shouldn't weaponize that term against somebody. That the worst thing you can do on when you're, like, trying to do something together is to point fingers at each other and then get into a fight while you're, like, trying to trust each other on top of a mountain. And when you think about what we're called to do, I think we should just be so careful to avoid friendly fire. The danger of division is, I think it I think that's just what Satan wants us to do. And one of the applications for us, and I think everybody in the room, is when you read the book of James, what's like the easiest way to commit friendly fire as a Christian today? What do you guys think?
Speech.
It's speech. It's easily speech. And I don't know how many times that God will have to teach me this lesson, the people around me this lesson, but our tongue is what commits friendly fire in our circumstances. And we as a people, there's two big lessons I think I've learned in my like short stint as a church leader, and we've talked about it this a lot, but the first one is, if you notice something is wrong, don't wait to address it. Like the longer you wait to address something, the more rampant of a problem it becomes. And the second is speaking, like, it's really easily to let your tongue commit friendly fire. And I just want to kind of point fingers to myself that is our potential to tear people down. All right, let's keep going here. So after we think about the importance of moving forward together, the second M of Summit is maintenance for endurance. Maintenance for endurance. So when Paul calls us to this big race, he says that the first S was think about the cloud of witnesses. The second was to unburden yourself. The next M was moving together forward, so getting a team and getting some momentum. And the second M is he gives this acronym endurance. What do you guys think of when you think of the word endurance? What are some synonyms? Just so everyone, I know I have everyone's attention. Stamina, perseverance, determination, commitment. Yeah, I think consistency. I think a lot of us have it. And what I kind of want to get at here is, in order to have endurance, you actually have to train for endurance. And endurance only comes through commitment beyond comfort. How many of you think that you're going to get endurance if you only ever do comfortable things? It's like almost impossible. I'm gonna try to survey the crowd here. Does anyone wear a fitness tracker in the room here? Raise your hand. I see a couple hands here. So there's been this a little bit of a new development in the fitness industry where people are starting to measure the levels of intensity that you have in cardio. Does anyone know what they are? They're very simple. Yeah, it's just level 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. And level 1 is walking, level 2 is jogging, level 3 is running, level 4 is kind of like sprints, and level 5 is this like max effort, 171 beats per minute. And they study this, and it's actually really, really, really good for you to get into this 171 beats per minute like pretty often. But the trick is that you can't maintain it. It's like impossible to maintain that. And I was doing an experiment preparing for the sermon where I was like, I wonder, I've just been thinking, I have this goal on a rowing machine on like a certain time I want to hit, and I haven't been able to hit it for like 3 years. And I've been looking at it, and I get to the level 5, and every time you hit it, you're like, I'm done. My pinky hurts, there's light in my eyes. Something goes wrong, and it's like the most uncomfortable feeling in the world, and nobody wants to stay in it. You guys know what I'm talking about. It's like it's suffering. It causes a lot of discomfort. And what I think we're also called here to do is to be a people who are developing spiritual grit, and that these moments that a lot of people want to avoid are really the moments that we actually are really good for us. And we should actually be intentionally chasing those moments. And I think that there's a lot of examples we can think of. I know our group talks a lot about evangelism. How many of you have think that all of evangelism is super comfortable, super straightforward? Yeah, I know there's a lot of us in the room who have gotten into this moment where you're trying to talk to people about your faith and you're like, man, I don't know how to bring up this next topic. But without regularly pushing yourself into that level 5 zone, whatever it may be for you, you're never going to develop endurance. And I just think it's one of those things that we don't want to be soft. We want to be a people of endurance. And so in a way, I would just encourage all of you to be pushing each other. What it, in the direction of this level five, spiritual level five, to develop this grit. And the more often you do it, the more you'll be able to sustain it. We were talking about this a little bit, that even there was a speaker at Sattler that talked about a lady that she came to the end of her life and was really, really faithful. And somebody asked her, like, oh, like, what did it take for you to like get to your level of faith? And do you remember what her answer was? Does anyone remember it? Washing dishes and a lot of prayer. And I remember, so I think that there's also like the corollary to this sermon is that, you know, there's this big expedition, but then the only way to summit is with a group of faithful people that are maintaining the base camps and like getting ready for people to go up the mountain. And there's a phrase or a book that Eugene Peterson wrote called A Long Obedience in the Same Direction. And I actually think that there's a lot to this too, that in order to ever have endurance, it just requires an immense amount of patience directed all in the same direction. And there's a quote from the book. Peterson says, "And yet I decide every day to set aside what I can do best and attempt what I can do very clumsily, open myself to the frustrations and failures of loving, daring to believe that that failing in love is better than succeeding in pride." Don't you love that? Daring to believe that failing in love is better than succeeding in pride. So some of us, our level five endurance, it's not going to look like other people's efforts. And I think that's actually to be expected. So the next, I think this is where we take a turn for a little bit of the more hopeful, in that although we're called to endurance, what will you expect if people are just always running at level five and not taking breaks? Dead. They're going to burn out and they're going to lose it. So after we realize the importance of endurance, we also have to really realize the importance of rest and grounding ourselves and understanding why we're doing what we're doing. So the I in summit comes from the verse, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. And the I is just going to stand for internalizing Jesus. When Brother Finney preached through the Beatitudes in the Sermon on the Mount, there's one of your messages has just been burned into my psyche about what is, do you remember what purity of heart is? To will one thing for your life. And I think about that beatitude often that's a Soren Kierkegaard quote. And I think that Paul is actually getting at this a little bit, that in order to endure a lot of things, you really have to understand why you're doing it. And I think part of the secret to that is internalizing Jesus and knowing that no matter what, like, you're doing this for Christ, you're doing this for the King of the universe. And a lot of the times we can let fear of man get in the way, but internalizing Jesus then opens the doors for rest. Has anyone here read a book called Practicing the Presence of God? Or, yeah, familiar with Brother Lawrence? Or there's another man named Frank Laubach who, if you ever get a chance to read it, it's a quick read. And at least I was in grad school, I picked this book up because I was inspired to read like the 10 whatever greatest Christian books of all time. And this makes the list. And there's this little bit of a concept there that both Brother Lawrence and a guy named Frank Blaubuck challenge people to do is, in your waking moments, try to bring Christ to your mind like once every 60 seconds. Has anyone ever tried to do this like meaningfully? I don't see any hands. So I read the book and I was like, I can totally do it for at least a day. Like I remember setting myself up for it. I read the book. I'm like, oh, I'm so inspired by this. I remember taking a pen and I like wrote like things all over my body. So I like would remember like, oh Christ, like, oh Christ. But even then when I attempted, even the slight attempt to bring Christ to mind once a minute, I failed miserably. It's incredibly difficult. And then I was like, the next week, I'm like, I'm going to go back at it again. I started writing, like, on all my belongings. I wrote Christ on all my tags so that, like, everything I touch would look at it. And I think that there's just something at this that we as humans are so easily distracted and can forget about our why. There's a lot of other like pithy sayings, like Nietzsche says, he who knows his why can endure anyhow. And I think there's a little bit, there's something to that. And so I guess there's just a question for all of us in the journey of life, in our expedition. What's taking your eyes off Jesus? Have you internalized him? What in your life is the thing that quickly distracts you? And I think if you know what that is, then I would say go back to step two, cut it out or work on it, and just get better and better of daily refocusing on Christ, and try to do it as much as humanly possible. So let's get to the final letter, the T. And the T could stand for just the throne is triumph, or the hope and triumph. And after we internalize it for Christ, one of the great things about the Christian world is that Jesus is already, he's already victorious. Look unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. Satan has already been defeated, who for joy that was set before him endured the cross. So I think there's a lot of messages around just like general Christian attitudes. And how many of you have been able to develop a posture of joy through like really hard things, like pretty consistently? Is anyone in here? You got it? So yeah, you got it down. Okay, so ask Zev his secret after here. But I think this just gets back to the beginning of my message, that Christianity doesn't have to be, I think Brother Charlton preached a message that, and I think it's right, that there are trials, there are tribulations, but at the end of the day, Paul says, who for joy that was set before him endured the cross. And when we look at our example as Christ, somehow in the middle of all the hardship, you can find joy. You can find rest, and then because Christ has already done that, I think it opens the door for even more risk. If you know everything's set up for you, it enables you to take risks. And spiritual endurance isn't just grit. It requires this understanding of joy. When in the military, we had a couple of sayings that I appreciate, because you get to design like people's hazing, and you would like put them in like muddy like pits for like all of Saturday, and you say you have to stay down there all day, like learn each other's names. And I remember there's this phrase of when we're around, like you get put in these circumstances, and there's a choice. It's like you can sit there in your misery, or you can embrace the suck. I think that's a term that sometimes I just say is like, oh, embrace the suck, I got this. Like, and it really helps to develop perseverance. And then the other one, if you're ever finding yourself in a situation that just seems like it's really hard and troublesome, I always like to say, it builds character. builds character. We used to say that all the time. Why do we have to do this again? Builds character. It's like you're marching on a road for like 8 miles. Builds character. But I do think that there's something true to that, that in the middle of all this, because Christ has triumphed, we can find joy, and life is an adventure, and not just the trial and not just the tribulation. So the S, we are surrounded by witnesses to gain perspective. The U, we are called to unburden our weights and our sin, and that gives us integrity, discipline, and unity. I think if any of you have joined another group of people who are also trying to like pursue discipline, it's really fun to be disciplined together. I'm part of a couple groups right now. We're trying to learn Spanish. There's some like calorie counting groups I'm a part of. It's actually can create unity. Moving forward together, the call of unity and the danger of division. So Paul calls us to unity. And I think that this is a silent takeaway, but there's a danger of division on the mountain. Avoid friendly fire, fratricide, blue on blue. M is for maintenance for endurance, developing spiritual grit and perseverance. Choose hard things. My wife is reading a book right now about, what's the title of the book? Something, Clark, what was it? Yeah, The Anxious Generation, and there's this, it's a pretty popular book right now, and she pointed me to this chapter of a concept of developing anti-fragile children. And I read it, and I was like, I want anti-fragile children. it's this idea that anti-fragile is actually something that gets better when you drop it, rather than, like, something resilient just drops and it's the same, but anti-fragile, you drop and it gets better. And I think we're called as Christians as we go through hard things to get better. I'm gonna also plug in a plug for my dating business on this one. Somebody once told me, I think it was you, Brother Finney, when you're dating somebody, design really hard dates so that you see each other having to endure something hard. Don't just eat good food and go to easy places. Like, go on a 5-day hike in the wilderness or something like that, yeah. And if you want help, I'm all about designing dates that will produce endurance. Internalizing Jesus, purify your heart. Seek that, try to get to that point where you can truly look yourself in the mirror and say, I can will one thing for my life, and that is Christ. And everything I do is around that. And then just the hopeful end that you don't have to endure persistently, that you can enter into rest, you can have joy in what you're doing, and it doesn't all have to be grim and something that's hard. So with that, I'll just add two more hopeful reminders. When you're summiting a mountain, you can't always see the summit. It's kind of hard sometimes. The fog rolls in and you don't know if the summit's there. You haven't been there. And I think in a weird way, in the Christian life, we actually don't know if we'll see like the true Christian summit, which I would say is like the Christ's second return. I always think about Christ's second return. I hope all of you do too, that part of our lives is to picture like Christ returning and viewing as our lives as a hastening of that and a stepping stone to that. But it doesn't matter because you know the summit's there and you know it's coming. And our lives are meant to be spent trying to get to that ultimate Christian summit, and faithfulness in our daily moments and the washing of the dishes and the daily prayers counts, and it will count for the future too. So moving forward is what counts, and discipling others isn't always a bad thing. So God, let's close in prayer. God, we think about just all the things around our lives and what it is to pursue you and to think about this cloud of witnesses behind us. God, I pray that you could help us to continue to be encouraged by them. Think about all the things in our life that we are called to take away, the sin and the weights which hinder us. Please help us to do that and to do that together, to maintain our discipline, to get endurance, but also to just keep your Son as the center of all we do. Father, tear down our pride. Make us humble. Don't let us make it about us or the things that we do. And God, we thank you that Christ has already triumphed and he is seated at your right hand. God, when we approach you and we approach your throne of grace, I just pray that that would be a constant reminder that your Son intervenes for us and he has made the way for us to pray to you. What an amazing, amazing privilege it is for us to be here praying to you today. And in your Son's powerful name, Jesus, we pray. Amen.